The title of today's talk is Return to the Echo Chamber, Race, Sound, and the Future of Community. Please welcome Luis Sokal.
Supportive of the work that I've done. It matters a lot to me because, trust me, I'm completely shocked and surprised that work I did 20 plus years ago when I was trying to pay my rent DJing is now being studied all over the world. It's quite flattering. All right, I was given 50 minutes today. I don't know if I'll take up all 50 minutes, but what I'm going to be doing is sort of two things at the same time. The first thing is going to reflect back on some of the work that I've done, particularly around Dr. Satan's Echo Chamber, which is going to be reissued in a collection with all of my sort of reggae essays. And I want to reflect on that a little bit and reflect also on reflecting on it. And the second part of the essay will be just talking about things on my mind, particularly around the relationship between race and sound. So, please be patient and bear with me. Everybody here okay?
Yeah.
I'm going to begin with a memory. It's a story about returning. Some years ago, I was invited back to Kingston, Jamaica, to deliver a lecture exactly 10 years after I had been there to debut Dr. Satan's Echo Chamber, Reggae Technology and the Diaspora Process. What I presented then was When Echoes Return, Roots, Diaspora, and Possible Africas, a eulogy, which at the time was an intended final chapter of a still incomplete book that projected the ideas behind Dr. Satan's into a world beyond its political assumptions. The book is about an Africa different from the one evoked and invented by Jamaican music. And it was a eulogy for that Africa because I believed that newer visions of Africa had emerged that outpaced the imaginings of black diasporic thinking. Central to this still ongoing project is the argument that the actual power of roots lays not in its assertion of place or truth or culture or history, but in its function as metaphor. Roots as metaphor. After all, the metaphor of roots has been equally serviceable on all sides of the political spectrum, from the racist to the anti-racist, the imperialist to the nationalist, from the essentialist to the fascist, from the fundamentalist to the neoliberal. All of these ideologies either claim ownership of roots or deploy it in some way or another. I return to this because roots is at the center of our global political moment, defined by an historically unprecedented scale of migration, particularly in the United States where I live, but certainly here in Europe. These movements are at work or reflected in a lot of contemporary music. Even the music that rejects or ignores these issues does so by entrenching itself in its own fictions or constructions of roots. Roots clearly move and shift and are deployed in the political and musical imagination promiscuously. And the great desire to find them, affirm them, claim them, reject them is always indicative of radical transformation. After all, roots matters most precisely when they are threatened. For those whom music is the primary site of political empowerment, historical sensibility, and cultural recognition, not to mention market legibility, this promiscuity can be profoundly destabilizing. Not just because it threatens the use of sound to bolster notions of cultural or racial identity or social or historical justice, but because it suggests something more difficult in a time of rootlessness, migration, and unprecedented cultural, political, and technological change. And that is this, that though music can be claimed, sound itself cannot be owned. And though sound may emerge from specific cultural and individual experiences, it is always about something else, and it is always for somebody else. It is as much about the other as it is about you, and that is central to the physics and the politics of sound, and clearly its ethics. In that latter essay, When Echoes Return, I argued that the Africas produced by blacks outside of the continent had become a problem, despite their important political histories. A problem particularly for new waves of African migrants to the West, suddenly confronting ideas about themselves produced in the black diaspora. Not just ideas, but also obligations and modes of racial being and affiliation. These ideas have arguably been generated more through sound than any other media or system of knowledge, and have been circulating back to the continent since the early days of recording technology. The ideas emerged from what can be conveniently called here today sonic Africas, because much of their inspiration and expression came from evocations of or direct supplication to the continent, and in doing so, they generated images and political expectations of their listeners. And it's not just reggae, though that music is most conspicuous here, certainly in my work. Jazz, calypso, gospel, spirituals, even Afro-Latin and Afro-Cuban music. People forget that some of the most formative music to shape contemporary African music is Afro-Latin music, going back to the 30s and the 40s. People tend to forget that, right? Just like people forget that before there was reggae, there was something called calypso, right? Which is so crucial to the politics and culture of modern Caribbean diasporas. But anyway, all these things had some conversation going on about Africa, some more than others. Now, these musical forms may have functioned in the name of racial solidarity or cultural continuity, which is true. But their Africas sometimes operated without African consent, right? And they showed how little control the continent had over its own representation, certainly in the early days. It's changing now, but this is a dynamic central to even Pan-Africanism and the Marcus Garvey movement and the Ethiopianism of the 19th century. It's important to know that those movements about Africa came from outside of Africa, which is very important. But for people on the continent, there's been a sort of contested relationship with these diaspora Africans politically and in terms of representation. We tend not to talk too much about that, and that's becoming more a concern. Right? As I've written many times, Africa, the primal sound, became a metaphor of distance, a space populated and inscribed by the longings of marginalized peoples who could only project their local struggles as universal desires. However, those Africans would sometimes lock actual Africans out of its secondary systems or echoes of racial and cultural meaning. For example, Africa, in a lot of these Caribbean or diasporic soundings, would always be located in the past. And that past would either be a noble racial romance or a colonialist ruin. The racial politics of, say, Jamaica or Cuba or the United States would take priority in these appeals to the motherland, despite the desires for universality and the actual attempts to create workable global resistance movements. Continental Africans, on the other hand, sought and needed something else. Not roots, but possibility. Not ruin, but futurity. So to that early assessment, I will add something still controversial. They sought not necessarily race, certainly not racial unanimity, but something quite like it or easily mistaken for it. Something that sound may provide where skin does not. I'll talk about that later. But the most important thing about this return, this memory, was not the scholarly context and these ideas that it generated. Most importantly, it was a return to a place I'd never actually been to. But due to its deep and enduring sonic footprints, its literal and figurative echoes, had colored my life and imagination and writing for so many years that it was like coming home only to find myself what I already and always am. A migrant, a stranger. It was a trip, appropriately with Michael Veale, author of the wonderful book Dumb. If you guys don't know that book, leave now. It was a trip with Michael Veale to the ruins of auteur Lee Scratch Perry's Black Art Studio in the Washington Gardens area of Kingston. And whether he likes it or not, I can't think of Lee Scratch Perry anymore without thinking of David. And I'm glad to see you. David Katz, you know. According to Perry, he burnt it in 1979 or something due to it being possessed by either unclean spirits or devils. Though others have said it occurred much later and by accident, as was the case supposedly with his other studio in Switzerland in 2015. This is all vague to me. But this ambiguity, this vagueness, only adds to the potency of myth. And reggae has no greater myth maker than Lee Scratchberry. That the Black Ark was a ruin was central in its significance, especially since one could argue that the Black Ark had at least two lives, certainly in my experience. First, as the site of some of the most innovative music ever produced in the history of human listening. And second, as a ruin, right? A space destroyed so as to feed its own enigma, now draped in conflicted narratives of origin. What fire? What source? When? Right? Myths of Rastafarian orthodoxy, racial pride, vernacular science fiction, and a quality of reverb that vacillated between divine vision and the suggestive workings of the occult. This is not to mention also the ruthlessness of commercial exploitation, as Black Ark has become a brand that often can't be trusted at all. All of these meanings and associations signify in the music Scratch produced there. The aquatic sound made by the oversaturation of analog tape, as well as phasing, eccentric chorusing and reverb, but also in the more experimental dubs cut for sound systems, which deliberately push against sonority and gleefully introduce ear-grating noise. And of course, this particular use of echo, the voices floating in and around the mix, traces of previous takes and material events rendered into textures of the past, and the occasional visionary glimpse of things to come. The obsession with collage, with noise and dense accretions of meaning is of course characteristic of his infamous lyrical performances, which range from deliberate logorrhea to divine glossolalia, speaking in tongues. And it exists in his personal style and taste for decoration, evident still on the walls in and around the house, at least when I was there, in front of the wreckage, the ruin of the Black Ark, alongside with images of the African continent and references to water. For example, I was told that under what was a drum riser was actually a pool, right? And I remember images of the Ichthyos, the Greek fish, which translates of the Son of God, our Savior. Arriving at the ruins of the Black Ark was like arriving at the home of reggae metaphor itself. Right. Metaphors produced in sound, but organized to suit narratives and cultural imaginings drawn from the cultural experiences and intellectual histories of the Black world as filtered through this island, this city, this place. Despite all the racial essentialism of Rasta and Black nationalism and the obsessive claims on reality in much of the music, the Black Ark was where roots were painstakingly constructed. At least constructed to work in what philosopher Don Eide called in 1970 the auditory imagination. And he gets that from after T.S. Eliot's use of the term in the 1930s to describe the internal auditory work of poets. People here who are composers, we used to call that the seeing ear or the hearing eye, right? That as a poet and as a composer, you actually hear as you compose, right? That's connected to what Eide would call the auditory imagination. I'll return to that in a bit too. Through the technology Lee Perry fetishized, roots were rendered prismatic, in my view, recursive, more like the rhizomes popular in that tradition of philosophy from French thinkers Jeluz and Guattari to Caribbean thinkers like Edward Glissant, right? And Antonio Benitez Rojo, two names you should know. These are thinkers who, like me, who seek not roots, but mutant multiplicities, things that are much easier to consider and imagine in sound than in other forms of media, certainly literacy. If roots, as Deleuze and Guattari suggest, are products of an arborescent ecology focused on dualisms, oppositions, and totalizing principles, Dub and the Black Ark, to my lesson, would break from those assumptions, despite their exaggerated commitment to organic myths and totalizing signifiers of Africa. For example, it's no accident that Perry would relentlessly describe the studio as a computer, or in highly technical terms, in advance, I think, of the island having full access to digital sound. And it's no accident that some of the most intriguing pictures of him from and right after that period feature him draped in patch cords and wires, hanging entangled like tubers. Though silent, but for the words of one of Perry's alleged relatives, who would not shut up, the remains of the Black Ark studio evoked those feelings that Rose Macaulay, way back in 1953, cataloged in her magnificent book, The Pleasures of Ruins. Where in her thinking, the afterlife of dead cities and destroyed civilizations produces, quote, a strange human reaction to decay. It's a pleasure, she argued, unique to human sensibilities in that ruins are historical due to the confrontation with time. In her reading of ruins, shot through with rhizomes, reclaiming the walls and buildings, returning what was once empire to nature or colony to bush, they are populated by ghosts that possess those standing in the aftermath. They reverberate in the mind and imagination in order to impose themselves on the future. For some of you out there, you'll recognize in this what we call hauntology, right? That now runs from Derridean deconstruction to post-dub electronic sound worlds and Afrofuturism, from scratch essentially to tricky to burial to the late critic Mark Fisher. Right? There is, of course, a sonic component to ruins, and that is echo. Those among you who are like me, involved in field recording or sonic archiving or site-specific sound work, you'll understand the unique pleasures of sound in ruined or abandoned spaces. You know what I'm talking about? It's a unique pleasure, right? Particularly destroyed cities and houses, factories and churches. Echoes not only require reflective surfaces, they also bear within them the material traces of those surfaces. And echoes, like ruins, connote decay, loss, signal loss, the threat of disappearance and the suggestion of a world beyond human presence, either post-Anthropocene or post-singularity. Right? Both ruins and echoes are quite obviously dependent on time. But as my mentor, the late great Ethiopian thinker and philosopher Tshome Gabriel, who I devoted my last book to, as he put it in his magisterial essay completed right before he died, Ruin and the Other, Towards the Language of Memory, such devastated spaces not only confront us with human greatness and failure, ambition and violence, they open us up to historical intangibles, such as minutia of voices, he says, which surge out from where silences dwell. As such, it is in ruins that a, quote, this is Tshome Gabriel, a healthy cross-cultural understanding between peoples, races, cultures can occur. I've always found that interesting in Tshome's thinking. What he means is this: if cultures, nations, and cities can be known for their prejudices, their concrete solidity, for their walls, in ruination, they become porous, accessible to those who can repopulate and remake them. Quote, indeed, ruins can be shared in a way that preservations cannot. To restore a building, to preserve it, is to close it off, to make its walls and roots solid, to surround it with fences, to protect it. We ask, protect it from what? From whom? Ruins, on the other hand, can be gotten into. They do not exclude, even though they may have been excluded, condemned, and marginalized. End quote. That's from Tshome Gabriel. What I was listening to in those moments when I could get Perry's alleged relative to shut up were Tshome Gabriel's intangibles. Gabriel's goal was always to make silences speak, to reach a new level of cognition. And to be clear, in all of his thinking, this was about sound. Because for him, and these were related to conversations we had a lot. Come on in, get comfy. These were related to a lot of the conversations he and I had when I was at the beginning of my work that led to Dr. Satan's, and right before he died. Silence for him was never empty. In fact, he would always argue that silence didn't exist. And I kept trying to tell him that that's what John Cage said, but the show was like, I don't know who that is, I said it. For him, listening had everything to do with race and immigration and cross-cultural understanding. Here's a long quote from Tshome. Quote, when two, and it's funny because Tshome was never, he didn't know much about music. And one of my proudest things in life is that I introduced the great Ethiopian philosopher to reggae. He'd never heard of any of this stuff. Towards the end, you see it creeps into his thinking. Right? This is from Tshome Gabriel. When two competing musical waves come in contact, they produce a new sound and correspondingly moments of silence. The nodal point where the space of silence is located is where we find interesting stories. These points of silence have existed throughout histories and throughout cultures. I am referring here to things that one cannot comprehend, cannot see, and things that do not appear to exist, but that exist, but that we know they exist. The question then becomes, not whose voice, but which voice do we listen to? End quote by Tishomi Gabriel. I recommend you go online. That essay is available. His students, including me, made sure a lot of his work became available online. That's Ruin and the Other by Tishomi Gabriel. And while you write that down, I'm going to pour some water. Anybody here who works on film, especially in non-Western film, you'll probably know Tishomi Gabriel's work. Third Cinema, that comes from him. We did a lot of stuff on sound after I introduced him to reggae.
Yes.
So that's my claim to fame. What I was listening for in the Black Ark were those spectral voices that generate, quote, a healthy cross-cultural understanding between peoples, races, and cultures. Now, I say this despite the fact that I've always been too cynical for reggae's often hypocritical universalism. Love, peace, and unity, while at the same time hyper-masculinism, homophobia, and a deep provincialism. Radical anti-colonial rebellion and cutthroat roughneck capitalism. Right. Human oneness and unity alongside an often parochial, provincial Afrocentrism. And I've also never cared much for the naive utopian romanticism that gets associated with either reggae or sound system culture. I'm not a hippie. But in that ruin, my mind was turned to a contemporary Africa bursting at the seams with new waves of migration. Refugees with genocide just a breath behind them, just as was the case with my family as we settled in Jamaica in the wake of the Nigerian Civil War. My thinking was turned to those new migrants facing a vicious anti-immigrant fervor in places like Spain and Italy, a brutal Black Mediterranean to supplement the Black Atlantic. This made my return to the Black Ark into what was described by Martinican thinker Edward Glissant, not, quote, a return to the longing for origins to some immutable state of being, but instead, quote, to the point of entanglement. That's what roots mean for Glissant. The point of entanglement, to where we discovered the complexities and contradictions in the first place, to where we either recommit ourselves to the tangled knot that wove us or abandon the struggle entirely. That was the Black Ark section. For me, that tangled knot has always featured a contentious weaving of two primary threads, two elements that historically make each other sensible, but which still have no essential or satisfactory relationship to each other, and that is race and sound. The race and sound nexus has grounded my work in literature, culture, music, and then technology because of Jamaican sound system culture, which foregrounds race due to much of the lyrical and ideological content, and technology by way of the obsession with the implements of sonic reproduction. But it's reggae's characteristic obsession with roots, with Africa, that for me turns the race sound nexus to the new migrations from the continent, what some African scholars in America are calling the new African diaspora. I know that there are people talking about a Black Mediterranean, and perhaps it's correspondent with what's going on in the States, the new African diaspora. Now, it's provocatively named the new African diaspora, because when you name something new, you're automatically naming something old. And nobody likes that, right? Right? It's provocatively named in part to differentiate these contemporary global movements from the dominant notions of Black diaspora generated and represented by Blacks primarily in the Caribbean, the US, and in the UK, primarily products of slavery. Yeah? Blacks from the presumably old African diaspora, it's turned out, have tended to be reluctant to engage these different Africans emerging in the wake, or the ruins perhaps, of Pan-Africanism. Or they are ignorant of it. A bit of this is actually going on in the United States, for me, the issue of sound, right? There just isn't enough formal recognition of the fact that a music like UK grime is as much a product of the legacy of Black British sound culture as it is of largely West African immigrant youth, articulating themselves in a context defined by Afro-Caribbeans, right? We need to talk more about that, right? Those who are aware of these overlapping diasporas tend to simply affirm historical continuity and racial solidarity. For me, that's lazy, right? They lazily assume that good, righteous feelings of pride and shared musical inspiration are equivalent to the hard work of building coalitions, right? This new African diaspora has long been present for me due to the peculiarities of my family background, half Nigerian and half Jamaican. But it became more pressing in the world of sound because after that visit to the ruins of the Black Ark, I found myself invited more and more to Europe, which as you know, is witnessing an explosion of reggae festivals and sound systems, right? Now, that's fantastic, but at these events, I began to greet more and more African immigrants on the margins, right? Ranging from either dreadlock members of the Islamic Murid Brotherhood, also known as Baye Fal, or actually imitators of Baye Fal, right? To strivers and hustlers from across the Mediterranean in a climate more hospitable to the so-called old African diaspora, its sound and symbols, than the allegedly new African diaspora. It didn't take long to see that these migrants were arriving into cultures that had little access to intellectual paradigms and formal histories of blackness, and indeed race relations, outside of music and popular culture. Right? Particularly in places like Germany, where in the wake of the Holocaust, public conversations about racism and immigration generated great anxiety, right? Not just there. Younger people were either naive or ignorant as to the complexities of colonialism and racism, despite their eagerness to engage them. The popularity of reggae and sound system culture, it seemed to me, had something to do with the desire to make sense of race, Africa, immigration, the legacies of empire, and the new global neoliberal order as it moved towards its contemporary ruin. After all, so much of the music was and is about that in some way, right? But it always in the language of metaphor, which, because it sits so deeply in metaphor, it enables it to apply to one's own context while at the same time is being utterly foreign to it. But the historical uniqueness of these new, and I put that in quotes, Africans, seem too easily lost in the images and associations of a Caribbean or African-American blackness, or older African diaspora, as they would say, the folks of the United States. They are, however, not reducible to each other. And to render them thusly is ultimately to marginalize the newer one within a hierarchy of blacknesses. That may sound strange to some of you, but not if you're a black immigrant. There are hierarchies of blackness. This is an issue in the United States, for example, where, for example, and this has changed this is central to my work since back then, more Africans have arrived from the African continent since 1990 than during the height of the slave trade. Think about that and carry that thought. That's amazing, right? Yeah. But few of us seem able to acknowledge the implications of that, right? Due to notions of black, and this is happening in the United States, that imply and privilege one group of blacks over the other. This has in places turned to great hostility in the United States towards black immigrants whose economic, educational, and experience and overall life outcomes and patterns of assimilation differ radically from native-born African Americans, right? And white racism seems to often pit them against each other in complicated ways. Surprise, surprise. This, of course, has generated among some African immigrants a great hostility towards black Americans. Not unlike the hostility between West Indian immigrants and black Americans in the early days of the 20th century, when Caribbean migrants began settling in New York and also began to produce quite radically different economic, educational, and overall life outcomes. Right? This isn't new. But it's new, but it's not new. Right? It's another wave of something. Arguably, some new African immigrants hide in those older associations. Much like a lot of Caribbean immigrants in London in the 1950s who were not Jamaican found it expedient to masquerade as Jamaicans. Some of you know what I'm talking about. Big Island, Little Island stuff, yeah? Due to the prevalence of that island's people in the sphere of sound and style. It's akin to what Edward Bisson described as the landscape of a zone shared elsewhere, where it can be strategic to, quote, find another place, that is, in these circumstances, to link a possible solution of the insoluble to the resolution other peoples have achieved, end quote. I almost named my last book, The Landscape of a Zone Shared Elsewhere. It's a great line. Some like to easily accept these acts of masquerade as sort of examples of unity and oneness, and they are. But these words, unity and oneness, tend to be much overused, and in my opinion, always vague and imprecise and lazy. Right? They require work. Part of my problem with what's happened to Pan-Africanism is to become a thing you say and a thing you show. Back in the day, it was a thing you built. You worked. And I don't think people are working. I think people are just assuming that signifying sonically or stylistically and or verbal performance is enough. It wasn't enough in the 20s, and it's not enough now. Due to this interracial masquerade, however, the specific histories and concerns of new black and differently black migrants can get lost in that landscape, which creates resentment and historical confusion. This can occur despite that sometimes bland universalism reggae can produce, that all are we are one, no matter where you come from, as long as you're a black man, you're an African. Mm-hmm. These sets of ahistorical cliches operate with the assumption that skin and sound are one, and that the needs of one are served by the needs of the other. This keeps us focused on the priorities of the older diaspora and ignores the details of the new. And by the way, I'm using these distinctions provisionally. The line between old diaspora and new diaspora is worth arguing about, and I'm not fully on board, but it's important that we acknowledge it, at the very least, right? But now let me focus on some more academic issues concerning the race-sound nexus, through which I hope to chart some pathway between black diasporas, or at least further expose their frayed edges. I got time? Am I cool with time? Yeah. Because, you know, to open up roots to critique, or notions of Africa to critique, or daring to fracture the epic notion of black diaspora is essentially to complicate something few of us are willing or able to take on. And that's race itself, right? And not just, it's easy to say that white people don't want to deal with race. I think that a lot of black people, we don't want to deal with it either. The deeper implications of intra-racial dynamics, you know? But sound has always been central to the production of culture. So I have faith that it is in sound that we will find or chart the future. As Jacques Attali argued years ago, music is premonitory, right? And he's right about that. Music doesn't foretell the future, but it tells about new and emerging social formations and cultural relations. That is absolutely true. Things start happening in sound before they happen in culture, and certainly way before they happen in politics, if they ever even get there. Right? This includes issues rooted through and around race. Music articulates not what is real, but what is possible. And it does so against current structures of feeling or law or power. And it is where most of us can or do confront issues of race and immigration. And when I say us, I think of people in this room. If you're here to hear this, it's because you're working in this space on some level, right? Now, it is true that for those of us who love music, particularly the music of the other, the relationship between race and sound has likely been sutured by cliches that make the two seem linked, that it doesn't occur to us to think about how those relationships were formed in the first place, right? I think we're all used to that. Yeah, black people and music have a relationship, no big deal. But how did that happen, right? That's not an organic one, it was constructed over time, and that's more and more my concern. How did we start to equate race and sound? That link between race and sound has been central to the marketing of black music for over a century. I may have started with reggae, but it's forced me to go way back, right, to music, but also technology. It's been central to the marketing of black music, and I put black in quotes, for over a century. I like to remind people, and I wrote about this in my first book, a lot of what was called black music back in the day, the first black music didn't have any black people in it. Right? Yeah, I see a lot of furrowed brows. I love that response. Mm-hmm. The first black theater or black music or black recordings didn't involve black people at all. It was white people performing as black people. Now, we know that that happened, but that was actually the market of black music and black theater and black drama, right? So that's important that our first blackness had no black people in it or had minimal black people in it, right? This is before they were even called race records. Some of you may know what was called race records back in the day. That's what they were called in the 1920s and teens, race records, right? And race records were actually, after the white performers of what were called coon songs. Ever heard of coon songs? See, you may not know this, but this is the core of the beginning of black recorded culture and music, even if black people were or were not involved. This was how it started, coon songs, right? Or race records. I won't get into that, but that's something that this has led me to, right? So notions of the Negro's so-called the Negro's innate musicality, right? That even inspired some people in the early days of recording to argue that there was some essential connection between the inhuman African and inhuman machines like the phonograph and the gramophone, right? Ancestors of the turntable. The history of this is fascinating. Right. As I talk about my last book, the last book, it's in fact by racializing these machines that recorded sound became increasingly acceptable in white households. Right? In the early days of recorded sound, nobody wanted these big ugly machines. Right? Because back then, music was something that was performed live, and it was had a piano, and it was about print the publishing, right, and scores. To get them to sell machines, they began to put images of blackface minstrels all over them, and that's how you started to sell this machine to white consumers. So that's a very crucial part of the history of race and sound, right? So this is central to the creation of an American popular music industry, and then of course globally. But the notion of the Negro's natural rhythm, which people still say, mm-hmm. maybe some of you in here have said it, I don't know. Or cliches about the African drum being in the blood, you know you've heard that one before, right? You may have seen it. These were colonial, ethnographic, and capitalist inventions, and they depend on a deep racism, even when expressed by fans of the music, right? Those colonial, ethnographic, and frankly racist notions would then be appropriated by blacks themselves, as they began to claim sound as the primary space of cultural debate and sonic warfare, when active resistance or access to formal political institutions where dominant technologies like literacy and film were either limited or impossible. And I say sonic warfare just to contextualize sound systems in a broader history of black cultural expressive spaces, right? It's not just reggae that did this. Reggae formalized it, but it really goes back to slavery, right? And the competition between different plantations and performance modes between different slave groups. Right? That's everything from sonic warfare to hip-hop back and forth competitions and all of that. It's such a crucial part of the African diaspora. Call and response, some of you have heard, right? Anyway, this strengthened the equation between race and sound, which then, of course, makes it difficult to describe it as racism. Right? When blacks themselves are taking on those racist notions and using them to empower themselves, right? But that's a complicated issue, and I've written too much about it. Blackness then, one could argue, as a musical expression of personhood and humanity in eras where that humanity is scientifically doubted or legally denied, blackness becomes as much a product of skin color and culture as it is of technology. Right. More specifically, debates about technology in which blacks themselves have functioned since the birth of recorded sound. Now, in terms of sound system studies, or Black Atlantic studies, this should remind us of the work, of course, of Paul Gilroy, which establishes what I still think, along with Horace Campbell's early work in Rasta and Resistance, foundational to what we're all doing here, right? Sound and sound systems have always enabled, in Gilroy's terms, an alternate public sphere, right? Alternate systems of knowing, debate, and cultural interaction. And I just want to stress this, again, it goes back to jazz and back to slave culture, right? There's a whole history of this, right? That's now shared with the world, but that's the history. To update this beyond race, and in the wake of feminist legal theorist Nancy Fraser, I would refer to it now as a subaltern counterpublic. Right? Meanings of race and sound and sex generated in this counterpublic sphere are important. That's what we're all doing. But they may be commodified and cliché. And reggae is notorious for a dependence on cliché that serves both its market function as well as its roots, in oral non-literate culture. Right? What we call cliché is actually a technique in oral cultures of memory and narrative. But even so, these clichés do represent the success of poor black people in their attempt to reject dominant colonial and racist meanings while appropriating some of the technologies of reproduction. Right? But at the same time, retrenching sometimes problematic gender norms and notions of sexuality. Of course, for those of us involved in scholarship and research and politics, we can't and shouldn't accept these clichés, no matter how much sense they make, or how noble they make us feel, or how much the primary practitioners believe them. Those of us working in reggae and sound system culture, it's always difficult when you know these ideas and you interact with the people who make the music, and the people in the music making the music say, no, that's not what I mean. But you as a critic, you're like, yes, that's what you're saying. A lot of us back down and just say, well, it's a practitioner. They're doing it. They know what's up. Don't do that. That's not what we're supposed to do, right? It's a part of a broader debate, right? A broader debate. But for those of us involved in sound studies or sound system studies, the racial politics of sound or the sonic properties of race are charged due to the fact that people still simply assume or accept the relationship between the two, or relentlessly assert that one is automatically or naturally productive of the other, or that anti-racist politics easily emerges from them. That's a problem. Reggae and sound systems may be a primary site in the modern equation of race and sound, in my estimation. But in looking for real answers to the relationship between the two, I think one must dig deeper into a longer history of black music in the context of slavery, colonialism, migration, capital, and technology. Much new work, however, merely accepts the relationship between race and sound without considering the methods and systems of power that have constructed that relationship over time and continues to do so. Right now, this is going to get a little bit technical, so please bear with me. I'm going to get heavy academic. I'll just talk about some books that are on my mind because I was reading them on a plane. A lot of this work focuses primarily and overwhelmingly, and I include myself in this too, on what we call that auditory imagination, right? Or an auditory cultural imagination. And this is where sound is a mode of perception. And listening is therefore a cultural act where we make associations that accrete into meaning and politics, right? This tendency is present, for example, in Jennifer Stover's book, The Color Line, The Sonic Color Line. Anyone ever heard of that one? It's getting a lot of attention now. The Sonic Color Line, Race and the Cultural Politics of Listening. I'm going to mention a couple of books because my point is that more and more people are trying to figure this out, right? Anita Eichstein's very recent book called The Race of Sound. What a title, right? The Race of Sound. I mention these works because they are some of the more notable works right now addressing the race-sound nexus in the U.S. And I recommend them to you not because they're correct or that my reading of them is complete, but because they're engaged in something I think we should all be engaged in, whether we're scholars, critics, writers, performers, or practitioners of sound. Now, brief discussion. Race in Stover's book, or racism actually, trains the ear to hear equivalences between skin and sound, much like we are trained to read differences between people and socially order and police them via how they look. Visual means. Her argument is that sound does the same. Right? Basically, racism makes blackness into sound, or brownness, or colleagues of mine, queerness. They talk about queerness and sound, and how, you know, what sounding gay means, right, versus sounding gay, and how that's constructed. right? These are things that people are involved in the States, right? In terms of gender politics, sounding like a man, sounding like a woman, how women vary decibels versus men in public space. Some of you have heard of this. This is important stuff. That's part of this broader conversation, right? It's important because it should caution a lot of us for whom sound or sound studies is automatically liberatory, right? Or revolutionary in its departure from or critique of the hegemony of vision or the so-called ocular imaginary. A lot of sound culture or sound studies emerges in response to the privileging of the ocular and the vision in Western culture. What happens if you turn to sound? Well, certainly you bring in more people, people of color, into the debate of modernity rather than what happens with the visual and the literate. But that's what's been going on in a lot of sound studies. Stolper's argument, though, is, however, in my view, it's a truism, right? Therefore, it's not particularly novel. We are all trained and disciplined to make meaning through our bodies and senses in a world structured by various forms of power. Why would the ear be any different, right? The ear is a part of that continuum. Eichhorn's work is similar in that white listening and how whites see blacks creates what she calls, quote, a distorted oral effect that she calls sonic blackness, right? Now this is a much more interesting description of the obvious, right? Her argument that there is this oral phenomenon that once you see black people, you're now conditioned to hear them differently because you know they're black people. Right. So the whole book, The Race of Sound, is about that. There's a lot of racism in that kind of blackness, sonic blackness, and we encounter it even in places drenched in black music, where whites make the assumption that their appreciation for black sound confirms that they're not racist. Thanks for laughing. You know what I'm talking about. Nothing could be further from the truth. Sound can, in fact, provide a mask for racism. So can sex. I might be forgiven for suggesting that these sonic Africas I mentioned earlier are sometimes product of a distorted oral effect when the supposedly old African diaspora sees or hears the allegedly new diaspora and shapes the needs of the latter into the priorities of the former. Narcissism is very much a part of our listening. And remember, the Greek myth of Echo is also the story of Narcissus. From this, though, the assumption that your commitment to anti-racism guarantees that you are pro-immigrant, that can be false, and we're discovering that, certainly in the UK, right? And the US. Just because you support one group of blacks, right, that doesn't easily translate as a support, an interest in another, right? That can be false, and that's kind of what the new African diaspora, I think, is trying to push, right? Black anti-immigrant sentiment is a thing. It's a real thing. And it's trying to fly under the radar. Or brown anti. I mean, people are always shocked in the United States for all Trump's horrible, horrible hostility to Mexicans. He has shockingly a number of Mexican supporters. Right? And people are like, how could that happen? This is how it happens. This, the old immigrants and the new immigrants. This happens. And I don't even want to talk to you about how many people in my family in the UK from the West Indian Windrush generation who are getting abused right now actually supported Brexit. Yeah. Right. Family, they're shocked now at what happened. But, and this is why. This was their argument, right? The old diaspora and the new. You know, those, anyway, that's a whole other thing. Sorry, y'all. Sorry. These books stand out because they at least attempt to do something more than just celebrate or exaggerate resistance or solidarity through music, right? Which is the norm in much work in politicized music making and writing. Resistance, solidarity. I'm not against those things, but like I said earlier, those things require work, not just songs. We should note by now that there's far more and less in black music than just rebellion and freedom. And know that in the world of popular sound, the line between resistance and commodification, struggle and fashion, resistance and the demands of the market, pleasure and power, are all so easily blurred that I think that we may want to spend more time studying how music contains these social challenges at the same time as it generates them, right? Anyway, I don't think that it's an accident that these new interrogations of race and sound have come after two generations of investigation into the historical construction of race and racialization. It makes sense to me that the questioning of sound would follow from and operate in tandem with the questioning of race, right? I've got 2 minutes, but just to say, just one page, almost done. I would also add another element, though, in the last two generations of black thought. The questioning of race and blackness and the acknowledgement that addressing the concerns and cultural expressions of one black group isn't necessarily the same as addressing those of another, this is central to what's called the New African Diaspora, right? And it was made very urgent, if you want some names, by thinkers like the Ghanaian thinker Kwame Anthony Appiah, mm-hmm. right? Black British cultural critics Paul Gilroy, mm-hmm. right? And it's a subtext of the New African global literatures, the so-called Afropolitans, Teju Cole, Chimamanda Adichie, and a trove of others, right? And a lot of the musicians in the new context of Afrobeats, with an S. Earlier critics like Gilroy, Stuart Hall, Carby, Hembich, Ian Chambers are central to how I actually connect the old and the new black diasporas, because their focus was also through a globalizing of blackness focused not on roots, but on how race is translated from station to station, and the differences of race in those translations, right? And it's important to know that it was always music that helped them chart that process, right? So, in conclusion, if the old African diaspora forced equivalences between race and sound and music that transformed the 20th and 21st century, shaping what Alex Wahelier would call sonic Afro-modernity, or Titi Jaji would call stereo-modernism, in my view, both products of Gilroy's counterculture and modernity, then what can, should we say about the impact of the new African diaspora, the new global immigration and its foundational impacts? Does it have a sound? Can we hear it? Are we actually listening? Tshome Gabriel was bold enough to declare before he died that we should not only learn to live in the ruins of imperial metropolitan culture, but see race also as itself a ruin. Not a space where roots hold us down, but where other voices transform us as long as we humble our ears and learn to listen. As utopian and hippie-esque as this may sound, it does return me again, not to the black art, but to what most of us truly thought or sought, what we looked for, when you really heard new music, or migrated to new cultures, or witnessed the face of what Emmanuel Levinas would call the face of the other, right? What were we looking for when we drifted through ruined cities and broken civilizations, following the base, drunk on possibility? Well, what we look for now is what we have always looked for, what we've always listened to. We may call it race or class or uptown or downtown, or desire or freedom or sex, but in truth it was simply this: community. Countries and governments being clearly unwilling and increasingly unable to provide, it turns us to what inspired sound systems in the first place: the creation of alternate institutions, sonic counterpublics, new communities that should not be afraid to engage race, since race is the property of our listening, and central to how we know and engage the other, however imperfectly. If we are truly in and amidst cultural and political ruin, then in the words of the great Trinidadian writer Earl Lovelace, it might actually mean that finally, quote, we are on the verge of actually listening, end quote. Thanks for your time, y'all.
Thank you very much. It was a great opening for today's conference. Now, since Ian cannot be with us, although he's following us, I've seen him clicking online to report about the conference, we are still very lucky to have Luciana Parisi here, who's just volunteered to act as a respondent the very last minute call that we placed on her. Luciana Parisi is a reader in culture and critical theory at Goldsmiths College in the Department of Media Communications and Cultural Studies. She's also a graduate from Orientale and a very good friend. So I'm going to welcome Luciana. And then, do we have time for some questions after the?
Yes, I get a short response and two questions.
Okay, so we'll have a quick response from Luciana. Thank you.
Much for your introduction to this section. I've the kind of, I think it's very important to, there's few things in your talk that kept on going back. So I've read your work in the past, and I always teach in relation to the question of algorithms and race, because obviously I'm interested in technology and the way the alliance between technology and race is specifically important to me to rewrite the modern question of technology vis-a-vis slavery, to think of the slave as a prototype of the machine. I was very interested about, want to hear more about that history that you're looking at, the branding of the machine with the black face. That's very interesting, because of course this, within that there is a lot of to be said, even in relation to, if you see, I don't know, I'm a little bit obsessed with some friends that I have here with the latest American movies, Get Out and Sorry to Bother You, as this kind of form of reconstituting this question of how race entered the white body. And how, nonetheless, the kind of machine-like form of race, and we can talk about blackness as well in a second, but the machine form of white, of race returns as this kind of muscular superpower, the branding of the black body as as an idea of a horse, okay, an idea of animality. And how this idea of being just a physical force without mind. I'm obviously interested in totally rewriting that, because there is a question of ontology. Yes. You know, the haunting that you refer to Derrida, there's a lot of rethinking of how there is a substrate of consciousness that cannot be just be erased. And if you've seen Get Out, you see when those characters have this sense of they're completely wiped out. Okay, so their consciousness completely wiped out. But actually, it's this glitch in which they all of a sudden can cry or laugh in an inappropriate way, and so this kind of question of a logic that is not just opposed. It's not the other. I know you mentioned Levinas and. Might be sympathetic, but I think I'm much more interested in rethinking in what Dasip talks about, the global idea of race, whereby there is this moment of post-coloniality is rewritten in the moment of there is no other question of the human, if not that. So there is no other in that way. So, and how the machine can bring that forward and rewrite another logic that has always been there. So these are few remarks. I don't know, I have more, but I don't know if we want to open to the floor. You want to respond, please, initially, or?
I won't respond, I'll chorus to add to the conversation. Yeah, I think a lot of what you're thinking is what the last book was about, the book The Sound of Culture, which it might be rooted in sound system culture, but it's really about the legacy of race and technology from industrialism and slavery all the way to artificial intelligence and algorithms. Some of you are thinking, well, what's that got to do with reggae? In my opinion, everything. Right? It's about black relationships to technology and that having a longer history. Sound just allows us to have the conversation. A lot of what I've done in that book is talk about how, and this is chorusing much of what you're saying. The questions that animated white racists and slavers was, do slaves have consciousnesses? Do they have souls? Are they just mimics? Are they human? And we know legally they were not human, right? It became clear to me that isn't it strange that those are the same questions we ask of robots and artificial intelligence now, right? And that's the context that you're bringing in, right? So that's what she means when she says the slave is the prototype of the machine. But that's not just an imaginative statement, right? The word robot is introduced in the English language in 1922 by Karol Čapek, who wrote a play called Rossum's Universal Robots, right? And it comes from a Czech word meaning robota, which is work, right? But in his definition of it, it meant slave, right? Mindless work, drudgery. And when he articulated that, it was in a play about mindless beings, and people are asking, do they have souls? Do they have brains? Do they have intellect? What are they? And of course, they rise up, kill all the people, and take over. Right? And then I was interested in the history of that narrative of mindless automata doing just labor, people asking if they're human at all, rising up, killing off their masters, and establishing a new regime. And I thought, well, that's an interesting trope. And I traced that trope all the way back to New Zealand in 1864, where the first person who wrote about that was Samuel Butler, a colonialist sheep farmer, right? In which he tells the story of machines rising up and killing their masters. But he calls the machines, for the first time, slaves. And he calls their uprising a civil war. Right as the civil war is happening in the United States, right? And so he also, and I started reading it, modeled how the machines acted in relationship to their masters from chattel slavery. So the history of slave and machine is intimate and goes all the way back. And I give you that whole conversation because I want you to understand how important that is as the prototype, right? It's not just a metaphoric one. But I think you're also interested in, well, what does that allow us more than just critique, right? Can we see in there some sort of, you didn't say oppositional, you said some other kinds of continuum of consciousness, right? That's a challenging one, and the reason it's challenging is because I'm sympathetic, I agree. But I think that so much of the Black diaspora is still in recovery mission. The recovery mission of race, identity, culture, past, and history. This is why Afrofuturism is crucial. It's an alternative to recovery. Right? But because it's so caught up in recovery, I don't think enough of us have actually taken that on. And I agree that we should. I think that we should. Let's move from recovery and start imagining, well, what kind of substrates allow us to rethink the human? And I think that people are doing it more. What we call Afro-pessimism, as you know, people are beginning to rethink the human and critique it, because in the same way that the human was being rethought by slavers, and Blacks responded by, no, we are human, and affirming it, right? Well, what if we no longer affirm that because the problem is, in fact, the human? What if the human is the problem, which is your suggestion, right? I think that that's actually something we're beginning to think more about. And in the context of technology, I think I'm probably one of the few people trying to do that, but I think more of us should, so absolutely.
Thank you very much. That's good to take it. I have more of a short people. You want to do the chair?
Excellent question. I think we have time for a couple of questions from the floor. So if you would like to speak. We have two Neapolitans.
Yeah, Luis, thank you very much for the, and sorry if I need to be quick, but maybe we will discuss the matter. First of all, a series of impressions. I was thinking the roots. I'm working on a South Korean novel called The Vegetarian, by a woman, and she's actually convincing me that roots, there is a female character who wants to become, or maybe has already become, a tree. Yeah. So, you know, I'm kind of rethinking the whole question of nature,
yes,
in terms of something new.
Yeah.
It's not a metaphor. Within the novel, it is a metaphor, but she claims that the woman really turns into a tree. So, I don't know, the status of metaphor is becoming a bit complicated, but that's not the point. Then I was also thinking of Derrida when he says that ruins is the only love that we have. But my point is different. You also write on Sylvia Winter.
Yes.
No?
The critique of the human.
I'm more
of course.
Denise is essential, but also Fred Moten. No?
Yeah.
I really would like you to engage a bit more with us on the question of blackness as the fugitive.
Yeah.
Because what you were articulating so in such a complex way, it really, I think, also needs to state what blackness is for you, no? Because to me, the question of blackness at the margin of what has been built historically, culturally, is also a way to be outside and create links and linkages with maybe the white ones who want to be part of that fugitive planning. So I don't know if I made sense.
Oh, you made great sense. A couple of things. I have time to respond?
So we take questions so you can weave them your answer together, or you'd rather one by one?
My brain would not be able to.
Okay.
And I shouldn't have drank that so fast. I think it's necessary. No, I just wanted to say a couple of things. The turning into a tree. Those of us who study cyborg theory, etc., we know that there are those who talk about organic cyborgs, and that the discourse of it comes from actually earlier notions of human tree, human organic hybrid. So I would say that exists, and I would turn your attention to that material because it exists. Jennifer Gonzalez comes to mind. You know the name? Okay, so you already know this. Good. The thing about Fred Moten and the blackness thing. Love Fred, know these people, respect them. I'm in the same zone, but I'm the one who's fugitive from fugitive. Right? So I appreciate that you see that in me. I resist that. What is my blackness? Blackness has become so commodified by black academics that I don't want to be a part of the commodification of blackness in industry. And I'm also uncomfortable with the long history of whites seeing blackness as oppositional, alternative, outside, fugitive. It's all romantic, but I just want to stay away from that. It's just a longer white history of romanticizing the Negro and romanticizing blackness as alterity. Maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe one day people say you were wrong, but right now it just bugs me. And seriously, intellectually. No, not Sylvia Winter. I'm talking about like Fred Moten and a lot of the Afro-pessimists, although he would say he's not Afro-pessimist. Just the fetishizing of blackness has, in the United States, I think that the fetishizing of blackness now is a response to the critique of blackness that black British thinkers, black Caribbean thinkers, African thinkers did a generation ago. And so they're doubling down on a blackness that is profoundly American. It's profoundly American, and I might be an American, but I'm an American of Nigerian-Jamaican descent. And these are conversations and arguments that are ongoing. So you're absolutely right, but you're right to notice also that I don't present it. And the reason I don't present it is because that's the argument I'm having with them and other people around.
Thank you very much for a beautiful talk and about what you said about ruin and silence, which was incredibly interesting and evocative. I suppose from the reply you gave to Silvana, which was anyway on the line of what I would have asked, some of it anyway, I don't have the time to ask everything, unfortunately, but that's it, that you don't believe in ever going on to an interstellar journey, unfortunately. Because I would have hoped to ask you for hospitality. So I'm terribly sorry for that.
Samir, is that a phenomenal comment?
I like glass for somebody. I like glass for somebody else. maybe brown people, who knows, they might have me, who knows. Anyway, my question is, among the many I couldn't ask, is, you know that there is a strong criticism of Afrocentrism.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, as you just said, it is sort of being just a fallacious idea of African American people, more or less, comes from that part, the idea of Afrocentrism.
Could you
say something more on this, since you spoke about Africa a lot as well, in spite of not going to go on the interstellar journey? And last thing I will tell you, as a white person, not very knowledgeable about the sound systems, unfortunately, back in the 70s, I was totally enchanted by Jimi Hendrix, Third Stone from the Sun. Mm-hmm. And this is where I started thinking about interstellar journey as being black.
You're basically saying that you see the trail of what we call Afrofuturism now. That's what we call Afrofuturism in a sense. And, okay, so she means that deliberately, okay. Right. Well, I can't remember, there was a question there too about Afrocentrism. I mean, Afrocentrism is not exclusively African-American, but the movement by Molefe Asante and those who branded it is very much African-American. Afrocentrism is Caribbean too, right? It's there in the Caribbean.
You know,
exactly, it's in the Caribbean too, and it's there in Brazil. They have that there. Different parts of Latin America, right? The centrist move as a response to colonialism, racism, and power is not one that, even though I critique it, I'm not saying it's not important. Without it, we wouldn't be here. These centrisms, Afrocentrism, Black power, Black nationalism, they're absolutely crucial to Black survival and existence in the world, right? And so, even though we acknowledge how important they are, at the same time, we have to critique it because it's so powerful and so central. Just like Garvey's impact was so great, but deeply problematic, we should critique that as well, right? So yeah, Afrocentrism, there's also class politics at work in Afrocentrism, there's also skin color dynamics, and some real gender stuff that would require its own conference, right, around Afrocentrism. So I just want to make sure that we know that from negritude, etc. It's not specifically an African American thing, but centrism is a necessary moment in all political and cultural struggles when people sort of draw a line and say, we are this thing that you say we are not, or the thing you say we are, we're going to revise it and redefine it in another way in opposition. That's centrally important, right? That's where roots come in. However, if you stay there, that's a problem.
Okay, do we have any other question? Maybe one more, one last, and then maybe Brian wants to close it.
Thank you so much, Louis, for this, for inspiring us.
Oh, thank you.
You said so many things that resonated with reflections I've been trying to give a shape to for years now, and I think what moves me the most is you talking about the hierarchy of diasporas.
Yeah.
And the new diasporas as being something that we don't want to acknowledge the history of the old diaspora, and about music being premonitory. And that's something I've been trying to make sense of for a very long time. So I'm based in London, so I'm thinking about new diaspora vis-a-vis genres like grime, Afrobeat, drill, and also the way they actually interweave, and the history they actually tell of that city and of its young, new diasporic population. But at the same time, because you connected the Black Atlantic to the Black Mediterranean, I'm thinking about trap and rap in Italy, and about Tunisian rappers, about Tunisian female rappers,
yes,
about Ghanaian rappers. So how these new diasporas at the same time have their own level of global communication that goes very much under the radar,
yes,
and is definitely a premonition of something to come.
Yeah.
often also not acknowledged by the older diasporas in that sense. So I just wanted you to expand a bit on new diasporas and the relationship between the Black Atlantic and the Black Mediterranean, especially nowadays when there is a wider share of technology and languages. Thank you.
Well, you actually did it for me. What you said was perfect. I'll just say this. Black Atlantic, Black Mediterranean, the real connection for me is Black Mediterranean and this thing called the New African Diaspora, right? I don't know how far that will go. There's a collection out there called the New African Diaspora, but that phrase is being used more and more and more, simply because there's no formal structure to ask these questions you're asking and that I'm trying to ask myself from my position, right? There is no template. Well, there is a template. The template is the old diasporas. And we know that that's a problem, right? And I don't know where this is going to go, but from what I've seen here in this, in the plan for today's conversation, it sounds like there are people trying to break out of old diasporas into new while respecting the templates allowed by the old diasporas, right? Communications technology changed everything, absolutely. My answer is going to be unsatisfying simply because I don't think we are there yet. I think that there are more and more of us pushing in this direction, and it remains to be seen what kind of parallels and templates emerge. But as I said, music is premonitory. It establishes new relationships and new possibilities that may or may not survive, right? In terms of gender, in terms of sexuality, in terms of access to machines, right? In terms of access to machines from far margins that then rewire notions of the human, right? I think it's pretty fascinating. My only point is, in the same way that no one could have looked at Black music in 1920 in America and saw that in the future, American racial relationships would transform based on groups of people who were by law forbidden to listen to the music of those other groups of people. That desire for the other, even though racist and sexist, that desire for the border crossing would then reshape political struggle, right? In the same way, looking at these machines and how they talk to each other and how these different groups and different diasporas connect with each other, I don't know what it tells us, but it tells us that something is brewing. And that's why no matter how frustrated I might ever get politically, by looking at new modes and networks of communication, there are new identities being formed, new communities being formed. What the template to understand it will be, I don't know. I don't know. But something is always happening.
Thank you. Just would like to add this little thing about the meeting we had, the visit by Ravi Sundaram from Rax Collective in Delhi. Just last week, you told us about this collapse of the social and the medial and the kind of the urban, the infrastructure of where the social and media and communication became one thing. It's a phenomenon we were studying in India's city. But I would like to leave the last word to our conference organizing and sound system legend, Baba Boom Hi-Fi, Brian Aquino.
Is it working? Yeah, okay. I will leave the last words to Louis for sure, but mine is just a comment. As you mentioned Jennifer Lynn Stover books, book, which it happens I discussed it pretty much in my dissertation.
Oh.
And basically, I think it is a very good book because it really brings some, I mean, not extremely new, but it really, you know, it set up some, you know, something on the table. But basically what it does, I think, she like set up the sonic color line and then she completely concentrate on what is going on one side of the line.
Yes.
So this sonic color line just becomes, I mean, a tool of oppression.
Yes.
And she explains it very well. So I wonder what's on the other side of the line, okay? Because as you said, usually on the other side of the line there is basically cliché. The rhythm of resistance and the natural black rhythm and stuff. So I guess between the two, there is a different idea of community,
yes,
you know, which we probably should look for, and that is why I really rate your work, because I think you basically concentrate on that between the two. So I would thank you. Thank you for this amazing lecture. Thank you.
Thank you to everybody, the three, for the wonderful paper, and just solicited so many interesting questions and answers and comments. And I don't know if you have a break now, we go straight to the next panel. We need a little break, so 10 minutes and then we'll be back. There's going to be two rooms, right, for the next, so we're going to be here.
That's so good!